The first official woman to run the Boston Marathon back in 1967.
Please welcome the unstoppable Catherine Switzer!
And there was nothing in the rule book that was against women running. It just assumed that no woman in her right mind would or could run a marathon.
What does the word feminine mean to you, especially nowadays?
Physicality is not the domain of a man. Women in sports are extremely capable and show their power. You know, give us the opportunity and we will fill the stadium.
This is the Loaf Podcast. Welcome back to the bakery, everyone, where we break bread with the world's finest. Today, we're here with Catherine Switzer, author, runner, and commentator. She's the first woman to officially run the Boston Marathon, though her story isn't quite as straightforward as that. Thanks for joining us, Catherine.
Thank you for having me, you guys. I'm really happy to be here.
How are you, first of all?
I'm really great. I actually just came in from a 5-mile run, and the weather has finally changed here in the Hudson Valley of New York. And it was screaming hot yesterday, and today it is sunny and breezy and beautiful. Wonderful. I'm leaving in 2 days to go to New Zealand for 2 or 3 weeks, which is the second home for my husband, Roger Robinson, and me. And we usually go back and forth when it's summer in both places, which is a little confusing right now because it's wintertime in New Zealand. But we've got to check in and see some friends. So we'll do that before we head over to Paris for the Olympics.
Are you looking forward to the Olympics then?
Oh my God, yes, absolutely. One of the things I'm most looking forward to is running the people's race. I love how elite sports now is beginning to encompass an outreach to communities. And in Paris, on the night after the men's marathon goes through the streets and before the women go on the next morning, there's a people's marathon at 7:30 at night, and there is a 10K at 11:30 at night. So I'm going to run the 10K, stay up all night, have some nice wine, and then go out and watch the women's marathon the next day.
Amazing. I'm looking forward. And I mean, speaking of the women's marathon, for those listening, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're the first woman to officially have run a marathon and be registered in a marathon. Is that correct?
Not a marathon. In fact, one of the first women to run an official marathon was in the UK in 1964. Okay. Dale Gregg ran the Isle of Wight Marathon. She was very, very active in British athletics, and she received permission to run, not start right in front with the men, but come start after them. But she was far from last. She ran very well.
So I guess my question coming from that would be, why do you think your historic Boston Marathon run is, and this might sound a bit comparative, but so memorable, and you're kind of seen as such a figurehead?
Well, it's memorable because of a series of photographs that were taken because of an amazing incident that you couldn't repeat if you were Cecil B. DeMille setting up the film shot. It was just so astonishing. What happened is that I officially registered for the race because my coach, when I showed him in practice that I could run the marathon distance, because he didn't believe any woman could run a marathon, but promised to take me to the Boston Marathon if I showed him in practice that I could do the distance. And when we did the distance, I didn't think it was far enough, 26.2 miles. We ran another 5 miles. We ran 31 miles, and he fainted at the end of the workout. So he was then completely convinced and helped me register for the race. And he said, you have to register for this. And there was nothing in the rule book that was against women running. It just assumed that no woman in her right mind would or could run a marathon. And when I sent in my entry form, I signed my name KV Switzer, not to defraud the officials, but because that's how I'd been signing my name as a sports writer. And the entry was taken assuming I was a guy. I mean, that's the only thing I can think of, is that they didn't either pay attention or they just assumed it was from a man. So I was issued bib numbers, which made me an official runner, which is absolutely required anyway if you're a registered athlete with the Athletic Federation, which I was. And during the race, during the first mile or so, mile and a half. The race director saw me and his race wearing numbers, a girl, and became so infuriated that he leapt from the press truck and went after me and grabbed me and screamed at me, get the hell out of my race and give me those numbers, and tried to rip the bib numbers off of me. I just happen to have a copy of it here, right? Okay. So that's how big the number was. This is the one that was on my back, and he missed the one on my front, and he just got the corner of the one on my back. And he, as I said, he did this in front of the press truck. So the press were all over this taking pictures, and I was absolutely terrified and scared. I was a young girl. I just turned 20. My coach was screaming at him to leave me alone, batting at him. And my boyfriend, who was running in the race, threw a cross body block into him and took the official completely out of the race, since he went flying off to the side of the road. So the press got this series of pictures of girl running, girl being attacked, and girl being saved by burly boyfriend, which either amused or outraged the public, because they went everywhere, these photographs. So I'm not just remembered for registering for the race, but for being attacked by the official and those photographs. That is what happened. But what happened in the ensuing years, and is still happening now, is that that story is resonating with people who, for whatever reason, are just disenfranchised or are being told they can't do something. And it has become quite an inspiring moment for them to say, listen, you know, if she can get through the marathon and change history, I can do the same thing, or I can do better in my own life. People, you know, don't realize that actually that, you know, it wasn't instantaneous after that moment happened. It took many, many years of changing regulations, organizing events, but it also became a fantastic career, you know, of working with women athletes, of changing people's thinking in 27 countries, you know, when I was at its height with organizing events. So it was amazing. And that turned into broadcasting, and that turned into book writing, and that turned into talking to nice people like you guys.
I mean, lovely. I mean, I was just reading your book, Marathon Woman. And what really struck me was how even people really close to you, like Arnie and Tom, was still kind of dismissive of that. Why do you think that was? Do you think that that's something that was really just ingrained in the culture at the time, this belief that women couldn't do certain things?
Well, of course, at the beginning, they believed that. Arnie, you got to understand, when I first met Arnie Briggs on the cross country course at Syracuse University, he was a volunteer out there, but he himself ran every day because he had been a runner all his life. He was 50 and I was 19, and he was ancient as far as I was concerned. But I admired him because he was still running. And I mean, he still had the legs, even though he didn't have, you know, he was kind of broken down and injured, and he thought his career days were behind him. But he took me under his wing. You know, he felt sorry for me, perhaps. I couldn't keep up with the men. I could go longer than the men, but I couldn't keep up with them on speed. And we ran every day together, and he would regale me stories of his glory days of running the Boston Marathon. So he unwittingly inspired me. But when I told him I wanted to run it, he said, oh, no, a woman can't do it. I said, why not? So Arnie said that no dame ever ran no marathon. And we argued about it. And he said, look, if any woman could, I think it would be you. But you'd have to prove it to me. And if you proved to me in practice that you could do it, I would be the first person to take you to the Boston Marathon. He never believed in a million years I could do this. But anyway, we trained. And the day came to run the 26 miles. And when we finished the 26, I said, well, I don't think that was far enough. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, no, we got to do another 5 miles. So we did another 5 miles. And at the end of the workout, he fainted. And when he came to, he said, women have hidden potential in endurance and stamina. So we had really discovered something that is changing the face of sports today. They thought we were crazy people. But that's when I could catch them, you know, stay with them. Anyway, we're showing that, you know, women actually have more endurance and stamina than men, and more flexibility and more balance, but we don't have the speed and the power and the strength. It doesn't make us one athlete better than the other. It makes us different athletes. So that's really a very, very interesting thing that is happening now in women's sports. And we'll see how this plays out. But I think it's going to be very, very exciting. I mean, it's already exciting. But anyway, Arnie helped me sign up for the race. He said it was very important to be official. I said, yeah, but I'm going to be noticed if I wear a bib number. And he said, you're a card-carrying member of the Athletic Federation. You have to register. I mean, otherwise, you're just a bandit. And I said, yeah, but I'm going to be noticed if I wear a number. And he said, I know, and I'm proud of you. It was really a big moment for him at 50 to come around and believe in women so much. So anyway, we packed up and went to the Boston Marathon after we sent in our entries. And he went into the gym at Hopkinton in Boston to pick up the bib numbers for the team. A guy on our cross-country team came, as well as my boyfriend, who was an ex All-American football player and a hammer thrower, a super jock. And he was only coming to Boston because if a girl could run and his girlfriend, he could do it. And I said, Tom, at 235 pounds, you got to do some training. And he said, no, I don't, because if a girl can do it, I can do it. I said, Tom, that's a lot of weight to carry for 26 miles. He said, if a girl can do it, I can do it. So he came to the race. Would you like me to tell you what happened in the race at this point?
Yes, please. Go ahead.
All right. So it was snowing and sleeting. So he had on heavy warm-up suits, and we left them. Everybody left all their clothes on. Everybody in the race was wearing everything from garbage bags to hotel towels. You know, we were so cold. Headwind, sleet, snow, really miserable. And under my sweatsuit, I had really cute shorts and top, but I wasn't going to be able to wear those. So this may have been an advantage for me, because all the men knew I was a woman, but the officials obviously were too busy to notice. I wasn't flaunting myself. I didn't say, look at me, I'm a girl. I was a runner. You know, I'd been running with men, and we don't care about gender anyway. You know, it's just, you know, whoever runs is a runner. And so I got into the starting area with all the guys. They were wonderful to me. Wish my wife would run. I wish my girlfriend would run. Go for it. We're with you the whole way. Very positive. I was so excited. Gun went off. Down the street we went. The press truck came past us. They had started behind. We were taking pictures from the back of the press truck. We were waving to, you know, the cameras, having fun like kids do. But a bus came up alongside that carried the officials, you know, the timers and the scores, which were, they were going to drop off along the way, and the scribes, the guys on their typewriters on the bus. And they were teasing the race director, a feisty Scotsman named Jock Semple, and teasing him, Jocko, there's a girl in your race and she's wearing bib numbers, Jocko. And he had a really short fuse. He was having a tough day organizing this race with the rain and everything. And he jumped off the bus and went after me and screamed at me, grabbed me from behind, threw me back, and swiped at my number. And he said, give me those bib numbers and get the hell out of my race. And I jumped back, and he grabbed me again by the sweatshirt and pulled me back, and then couldn't get the front. So he went for the one on the back. And that's what ripped this corner of my bib right here from my back. And Arnie was screaming at him, leave her alone. She's okay. I've trained her. Leave her alone. And he smashed Arnie. And then my boyfriend, the big football player, came running full tilt and just did a shoulder charge and took the official out of the race completely. The last I saw of him was him flying through the air. My stomach dropped out of my body. I was so scared because I thought, oh my God, I don't know who this guy was. I was already terrified enough, but now we've killed him. And because he hit him very hard, and Arnie was scared too. And Arnie said, run like hell. And down the street we went, and the press truck accelerated and stayed alongside of us and were yelling at me, "What are you trying to prove? Are you a suffragette? What are you doing here? What are you?" And I mean, there are tears in my eyes. I'm so embarrassed and I'm scared, witless, right? And they kept shouting at me, "When are you going to quit? What are you doing here? You don't belong here." Really, really rude. And they couldn't believe I was serious. And I said, "I'm not trying to prove anything. I'm only trying to run." And they said, "Well, when are you going to quit?" I said, "I'm not going to quit. I'm not going to quit." And finally, you know, I just turned to Arnie. I said, "I'm going to finish this race on my hands and my knees if I have to." You know, everybody says that women can't do it and that when they get an opportunity, they can't do it anyway. And I said, "I can do it. I run 31 miles last week with you in practice. I know I can do this." And he said, okay, well, let's just get it together. Finally, the press truck left and the race went on. But, you know, when you retell the story, I'm watching your face, actually. Even you were laughing. It's hilarious, isn't it? Girls running in a race and she's attacked by the official and she's saved by her burly boyfriend. Yay. Yeah. It's a great Shakespearean drama. But anyway, it was terrible. Mm. It was really a terrible moment. And yet during the race, I was increasingly determined to finish, you know, slowed down, made that the priority to finish and did. But another thing that's important to remember, and for people who are runners, they will know this, is that when you run a long race, a marathon in particular, you really go through kind of a lifetime of experience. You know, your soul is just laid bare. And by the time you get to about 33Ks, you know, you're on fumes anyway. And really, you let all kinds of anger and emotion go. And up to that point, I really had murdered this official just about every way a person could be murdered. And then I realized, you know, it's not his fault. It's not his fault. He's a product of his time. That's all he knows. He doesn't think women are serious. He doesn't believe women have this capability. And it's going to be up to women like me to show him that it can be done. And it's going to be a slow race, but I'm going to finish. And indeed, I did. I finished in 4 hours and 20 minutes. I knew it was a jogging time in those years. But I finished the race and I proved my point. I kept my number intact. I was worried about it. I was worried that they were going to like send some police or something out to pull me off the course. But I was really, really grown up after that. You go through, as I say, you go through a lifetime in every marathon. But when I finished that race, I really, really had a focus of what I had to do. I felt terribly responsible for what I had done. And I knew that I was going to not only have to change people like Jacques Semple's opinion about women's capability, but I was going to have to somehow show other women who were very resistant. Many women were our own worst enemies for a long time. They were very resistant to change and doing anything physical because that somehow they've perceived this as unfeminine, which we'll talk about in a minute. But I had a lot of work to create these opportunities for women to show them that they too can do something really amazing and become empowered by it, because running was extremely empowering to me, life-changing, in fact.
Yeah, when I was reading your book, I was really struck by the different reactions to you running. Some of them, like, everyone seems to have an opinion on it. Some ranging from really positive and encouraging, and some really quite aggressive, and some almost quite ridiculous. And this is something which you discussed before when you noticed me laughing. It's that this is something which is on one level really serious, really quite problematic, deeply problematic. But at the same time, there's something almost quite ridiculous looking at it, especially now from a 21st century perspective. And that's something you touched on in your book as well, when you mentioned how women playing basketball, there was this worry that their uterus might be displaced. And I think back then, you can comment on this here more accurately, but people truly believed it. I don't think it was something that some might have come from a position of hate, but some people just truly believed that.
Absolutely. Women did believe that. And you can understand why they would then therefore feel afraid of taking part in sports, especially an arduous activity. I mean, because the marathon in those days also for men was kind of like, oh, Pheidippides dying, you know, there was none of this, you know, Elliot Kipchoge thought it was like, oh my God, you know, it was your Pheidippides coming in with the message and you're going to die. And so women were afraid of looking sweaty and horrible also. The other myth was you're going to get big legs and grow hair on your chest. There was this feeling that you would turn into a man, maybe. Mm. Okay. Or maybe a lesbian, which was worse in those days. You know, like, it's so wonderful now. There's so much freedom now from that kind of belief. We got other problems. But you can't blame a woman who knows nothing else. Also, just like I couldn't blame Jock Semple for attacking me because he didn't know any better. That's the way he perceived women. I was angry with women for their dismissal of the condemnation of me, let's say. But I also could see the fear in them because people don't like change. It's sort of like the devil you know is always better than the devil you don't. But anyway, I kept being worried about them because A, they were not having an empowering experience and they were not experiencing the joy and freedom that running can give in a cheap, easy, and totally accessible way. You know, you don't have to be rich and join a country club and or go to a gym. You know, you can just go out and run. It's free. So I was upset with that. And yet I understood their fear. I just wanted to create something that would eliminate that fear. And this is getting ahead of our story, but I have done that with 261 Fearless, which is, you know, my nonprofit named after my bib number. So we can talk about that later, but that was one of the determining moments for creating that.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting that you ended up making up with Jock Semple. You ended up kind of, I don't know, is forgiving the right word?
Yeah, it is the right word. Yeah. But see, I forgave him when I was 32 Ks in the marathon because I realized he was a product of his time and he didn't know anything else. And the marathon, this marathon was his baby and he felt that I was endangering it. Okay. So he was angry. Okay. Fine, you can feel that way, but don't say women shouldn't be here. So I need to show you, Jock, it's okay that I deserve to be here. And I couldn't do it that day because he was just completely out of control. But in fact, it took 5 years. And in the way I decided to do it was first become a better athlete because that's what he understood. And when I ran my 4 hours and 20 minutes, which is perfectly acceptable nowadays for his marathon, especially one under such conditions, right? He said, I could have walked it that fast.
Wow.
He called a press conference and said, I could have walked it that fast. And the press called me and said, did you know he said this? And I said, well, basically you can't walk it that fast, but you know, Jock Semple himself used to be a good athlete. So, of course, he doesn't understand that a 4 hours and 20 minute marathon is okay. And I'll do better. I improved to 2 hours and 51 minutes. And that was in 1974. At the time, it was sixth best in the world and third best in the U.S. And he had to present me with a trophy when in the Boston Marathon that year. And the trophy was broken. It had broken in the packing case. And so he was a little embarrassed and unmanned, actually, when he presented me with the trophy. But he said, I've been mad at you for 5 years and you deserve a broken trophy.
Did you end up returning the trophy to get a new one? Because I read in the book that he offered that kind of option.
Yeah, no. I kept that broken trophy because it's now in a Hall of Fame with the story, you know, because I deserve the broken trophy. I think it's hilarious. I could care less about the paraphernalia of running, but I was happy to put the trophy in a Hall of Fame, but the story made it really wonderful. But anyway, no, but I mean, I did forgive Jock and I, And I laughed and I cajoled and I was kind to him for all of those years. And we did become very good friends. He never said he was sorry, but that's okay. You know, he had his own way. He came up to me on the start line of one of my races and gave me a big kiss and turned me around to the TV cameras. And he said, "Come on, lass, let's get a wee bit of notoriety."
I guess in terms of maybe perhaps in his words, that was, that's one way of saying sorry, perhaps not.
It is.
Not too direct.
Yeah. But, and then famously, I guess, I visited him just a few hours before he died.
Yeah.
And people say that's a huge amount of forgiveness. And I said, you know what? I mean, I really love Jock Semple. You know, he'd done a lot for marathoning. He was a good runner himself. He came from such a tough background in Glasgow and immigrated to the US with a tool bag. And that was it. And made a success of his life. He hit first and asked questions later. That was the way he felt he could survive. And when I went to visit him in the hospital and we had the last talk, people said, "Whoa, that's a lot of forgiveness." Here's the point: is you can't carry that kind of baggage around. If you have anger all the time, you're not going to really make much progress. You can funnel your anger into something else and make it positive. And I have to thank Jock Semple every day of my life for tacking me in the Boston Marathon, because he wouldn't have created those photographs. I'm not famous. The photographs are famous, but they gave me a vehicle for a huge change in women's sports, propelled me to be a major driver in getting the women's marathon into the Olympic Games, for changing millions of people's minds about women's capability, and for helping me launch a nonprofit foundation, which probably in the fullness of time will be enormously successful. You know, I probably won't live to see that. Because, you know, nonprofits usually don't reach fruition for a long time. But we're going great. We're already in 14 countries and we're helping women who've never taken a step of running in their life and they become enormously empowered.
Yeah. Let's talk about 261 Fearless, actually. So you guys, you were launched in 2015, if I'm not mistaken. And, you have an ambassador program, club training system, you run events and you use running as kind of a means to empower women.
Right.
Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Happy to do it. We were launched in 2015, but we really call our birthday 2017, because okay. That was the 50th anniversary of me, my Boston Marathon, famous Boston Marathon. And I ran the race again on my 50th anniversary, which was really the happiest day of my life, because at that point, the Boston Marathon finally had become 50-50 men, 50 women, men and women. Everybody on the course knew the story. Everybody was out there with big 261s. I did 13 interviews on the course. I hugged every kid I could hug. And I only finished 20 minutes slower still than I did when I was 20. So, you know, at 70, at 70, it was really, really pretty good.
And they retired your bib number as well.
They
right?
retired my bib number, which was really exciting. I think most exciting though was having the first woman president of the Boston Athletic Association meet me at the finish line. In 135 years, she was the first woman president. In wow. 2017, can you imagine all those years? And my husband, Roger Robinson. And then, you know, I'd always wanted to fly across the finish line and put a big smacking kiss on my Romeo, and I did. What we do very simply is we give women a safe place to run, a safe community, non-judgmental, reach out, take the first step with us. It's always taking the first step in anything that's the hardest. And so sometimes, you know, you're locked inside, or you're suppressed by a religious or social convention or domestic abuse, and you just need a friend and to make that first step. And so country by country, we have been creating community clubs where we have a trained coach and she starts a group. And every week there's a meet run with exercise and community, and running is always involved, because running is the thing. Even if you come and walk, you know, you're out moving with people and it becomes an empowering experience. And if you're empowered, you can change everything in your life. And we're hoping that we can help women make decisions about every aspect of their own life. And so far, it's going great.
Yeah. Just off of that, what kind of advice would you give someone to start running in general? And I'm asking this because often you are not just a woman runner, right? You're a runner, full stop. And I think that's also a really important distinction to make. So as a runner, not just as a female runner, why do you think running is so important? And what advice would you give someone to start running?
First of all, running is important because it's instantly empowering for every person, every time, especially for women who often don't have a source of empowerment or self-esteem. Okay. Wow. I did that. Even if it's only 100 meters, you know, and then that becomes a half mile, that becomes a mile, that becomes a 10K, becomes a marathon. It's amazing. Okay. You realize then that you can really do anything if you put your mind to it and are persistent. And also because I mentioned before, it's easy, it's cheap, and it's convenient and accessible. You know, we think that women who are not empowered or, you know, like under a burqa in Saudi Arabia or North Africa or something, you know, and she's just as likely to be your next door neighbor. And so the sense of community is extremely important. And you always have a friend. I often say that the coffee we share afterwards is just as important as getting together and run. But the running is the thing that kicks up the endorphins and gives you the sense of accomplishment. The other is the community and the friendship. That's very, very important. So as a runner, the advice I would give to people, to start running, is to start walking out to your mailbox every day and then jog back. And then the next couple of days, jog out to the mailbox and jog back home. And then go out and go to a park and say, okay, I'm going to walk for 10 minutes, but I'm going to jog 2 minutes of those. Just starting to string it together, you know, like a string of pearls, put them together. And it's amazing how fast it accumulates. And it's quite addictive because it's easy and it is very refreshing and it's very meditative. And people say, oh, no, it hurts my legs. It hurts my knees. It hurts them. Well, you know, do some other exercises and build up your strength and you'll get past that.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think perception of women in sports, I mean, it's obviously changed, but to what extent do you think this perception of women in sports has changed? If I see a woman running to the letterbox now, I'm certainly not going to think that she's going to get injured or that she's in some way a man or a lesbian, right? So do you think it's changed quite substantially?
Totally, it's changed. Absolutely changed. You know, I know probably because I'm old, but basically I said to my husband, what's great about going out and running now is nobody honks their horn or shouts at me. Mm. But it's not just because I'm old. It's because I'm a woman, but people don't care. There are more women out running in the streets now than men. And in fact, in the United States, of all participating runners, 58% are women. That's in races as well as in running in general. That's a huge social change.
That is huge.
Huge change. But it's going global. You've seen it in the UK too, though.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it's clear that the perception has changed. And I mean, perception of women has changed. So that's, I'd say, maybe the obvious bit. But when do you think this started happening? In what period? Was this still the case in the 80s? Or how
did you experience it? I would say in the 70s, because the 70s were a time of real radical change. The 60s, of course, were a radical change. So, but that's going back too far for most people. My first run was in 67. We were really working on rule change, but I would say mid 70s, maybe 72 was a big breakthrough year. And I'll tell you why. It's because we organized the first ever women's road race in the United States, in 1972. And it was called the Crazy Legs Mini Marathon, and it was one loop of Central Park, which was 6 miles. So that was a big deal. That's pretty far, right? And it was a sponsor launch for a sponsor product, a ladies' shave cream, in fact. And it was called Crazy Legs, this product. And they wanted to do a women's only marathon because we had just been made official in the Boston Marathon. Mm-hmm. And we thought, oh my God, there's only about 8 of us who can do a marathon. This is not going to be a successful product launch. So we convinced them to call it a mini marathon by doing only 6 miles, one loop of the park, which made it really handy. Oh my God, we canvassed the entire world. We sent out thousands of entry forms everywhere we could. And on the day, we had 78 women. Well, that's like 7,000 women now. Nobody could believe we had 78 women who could run 6 miles. Yeah. Well, oh my God, it was so festive and fun. And we all wore the same t-shirt. And of course, it made global news. The product launch was so successful. The company was really thrilled, but it gave me the idea that sponsorship is going to be the key to creating events uniquely for women that are non-intimidating, in fact, welcoming, fun, feminine. And if we're all women together, nobody's going to be intimidated about being, oh, I'm too old, I'm too fat, and everybody's looking at me. We don't care if we're all together, right? So that's what happened. And I took my plan to the world's largest cosmetics company at the time, Avon Cosmetics, and said, we could do this globally and get the women's marathon in the Olympic Games. And they said, well, we're not sure we want to go that far, but you know, if you can think like this, we'd like you to work for us. And please let me do one race, I said. And we did one race and it was massively successful. And then I said, let's launch that program. And we went global. And eventually we had 400 races for over 1 million women in 27 countries, which fulfilled the Olympic requirement for international participation. And in an extraordinary meeting of the IOC, International Olympic Committee, they voted in the women's marathon in 1981 for the 1984 games, skipping entirely the 3,000 steeplechase, the 5,000, the 10,000, went right to the marathon. So, yes. And if you can, everybody in the whole world knows that, you know, 26.2 miles or 42.2 kilometers is a long way. Yeah. And they're watching it on television. 2.2 billion people watch it on television. So that's what changed notions is, you know, everybody knows the distance and they're seeing women running and they said, you know, oh my God, you know, that's a woman running that far.
It is impressive. It is impressive. I mean, I find it impressive, not least because I can certainly not run 43 kilometers.
But, yes, you can. You absolutely, anybody can do it. Really, anybody can. You know, have you ever gone out and stood on the sidelines and watched like the London Marathon?
London Marathon, but I've seen people running, the marathons.
Okay, marathon. Okay.
My mom used to run marathons.
Oh, okay. Well, you see, if your mom could run marathons, why couldn't you run a marathon?
That's a good question. So I don't have an answer. I don't have an answer. Maybe it's something to do with determination. It's probably something to do with determination and
persistence. No, it's persistence. It's persistence. And you know what? Running's not for everybody. Maybe you like to swim or play lacrosse or golf or whatever. It's okay. It's just that just about everybody can do it. And when you go and watch a marathon and you see crippled people and people without legs and people who, you know, are, you know, I mean, you can see everybody. It's so inspiring.
Yeah, I wanted to interrupt. I wanted to pick up on a word that you mentioned earlier, which was feminine, because I find that word quite interesting. And in your book, you write towards the beginning of your book, you write of the men of your family, that the women they chose as wives were their equals, feminine, yet capable and resolute. So what does the word feminine mean to you, especially nowadays?
Okay. Feminine. In the way I described it in my book is that they were womanly and perhaps also sexy. I mean, not beautiful necessarily, not even pretty necessarily, but attractive in a sexual way. That they were loving people, you know, that they respected and loved their husbands and were loved back. That was important. But they had to be capable because my family came from really tough farming stock. They were homesteaders. I mean, back in, you know, and Pennsylvania Dutch farmers, those women had to really pull their weight working. They, you know, they didn't sit at home and crochet. They were hardworking women. Education was also a priority in the family. You know, you get the best education you possibly can. I've just been going through letters of my parents, interestingly enough, in the 1930s. In the heart of the Depression, both of my parents, very poor kids, managed to get through University of Illinois on scholarship and working jobs. Amazing. Amazing what they did.
Did running make you feel more feminine?
It did, because it made me feel sexually powerful. As a female person, it made me feel my body is amazing. And that is, I think, probably the strongest sexual feeling that people can have, male or female or transgender, whatever, when your body can do much more than you ever imagined it could do. It also made me feel in a funny way, strangely religious, appreciative, you know, grateful. That's it. Running has always given me a great sense of gratitude for my environment, for my body, for my health. And even when things happen, like a running injury or a fall or something like that, you know, that comes with the territory. You know, you can't always be 100%. But so I think what makes a woman feminine in terms of her own gender power, let's say, maybe a man too, is if, you know, you have your full physical capability or up to your limit. I mean, you could be a disabled person, you can still have this feeling. That's what I mean. Physicality is not the domain of a man. We always thought it was. Mm-hmm. And now women in sports are extremely, extremely capable and show their power. The women soccer players, the women runners. Oh my gosh, I'm watching our Olympic trials right now. I mean, it's the sprinters and the track. Unbelievable performers. I mean, they look like they're walking out on the stage. A minimum clothing fashion show.
That's a good way of putting it. Yeah.
Yeah. There's extremely revealing running clothes and costumes, which we could never have gotten away with in the 70s, even the 80s, which are entirely acceptable now. And I applaud it wholeheartedly. You know, sports allows us to express ourselves, as we all know, in ways we otherwise can't do. I mean, you go to any English soccer game, football game, oh my God, the stadium is filled of all these people who enjoy this amazing panoply of color, of human performance, of just kind of raw physical expression. It's amazing. Mm. It's transformative.
So what do you think's next now? Because do you think there's still inequality in your eyes? Because in my experience, at least, I still feel that there is still a stigma of women in relation to sports. Not least, I was recently watching the Euros and I had someone criticize the commentator for being female. So I still feel like there's, and this was just a few days ago. What do you think?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think there's an inequality, and the inequality comes with pay, with sponsorship, with visibility, and with participation in the sport. I mean, it's interesting to me that the big leagues in football, which we call soccer, okay?
Yeah.
Sure. They're not blind to this. They have women's teams now, you know, that they have the women's farm team, that they're bringing the women along. You know, they don't want to miss this economic opportunity because it's getting ready to explode. Women's soccer is going to become incredible.
In England, it's been huge recently.
Huge. Listen, we look at these guys and they're, wow, look at that performance. And then the women too, are going to say the same thing. They're going to become superstars. Everybody's going to be wanting to jump on this economic bandwagon. Right now, women are impatient for it to happen because we really need that payment. You know, we're performing. On the other hand, we have to fill the stadiums. Okay. It's not just the World Cup that fills the stadium and then everybody appreciates the women or the Olympic Games. we need to fill the stadium every week. And just like the men do, it'll come. I mean, I was there when Billie Jean King, you know, created women's professional tennis. And the men said, who is going to pay to watch women play tennis?
But
the rest is history.
To bring it to a more controversial question, what do you think? What do you think the solution is in terms of women's pay? Do you think it should be equal, or do you think there's this idea of having it proportional to viewership? Because this is quite a big question around making pay equal in sports. Some people say, well, the men have far more viewers, therefore they bring in more money.
Well, there's some legitimacy to that. The point is that, you know, give us the opportunity and we will fill the stadium. Okay. We're not quite there yet, but we will be. The point is don't say we won't fill the stadium. Give us a chance to fill the stadium. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good way of putting it. And I do think things are changing, and just from seeing, you know, reading your book and understanding the perception of that time, I do think society has come a long way. I do want to, you know, as we come to a close here, commend you for also, you know, for having the courage to do something like that, running as a, you know, a singular woman among men who, some of which didn't want you to be there.
Never a male runner, though.
Never really.
There were one or two who made kind of a funny comment like, well, maybe next year I'll get my wife to run the marathon or something like that, you know, ha, ha, ha type of thing. But they, you know, they've calmed down. I mean, I remember one guy, you know, when a woman had run a really terrific marathon, and everybody's saying, oh my gosh, that's fantastic. And somebody turned to me and said, she'd run a 2:42. Okay. This guy turned to me and he said, what do you think an ultimate performance for a woman marathoner is? And I said, oh, you know, within the next couple of years, we're going to see a woman run around 2:30, 2:32. And this guy from across the room jumped up and he said, that is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. And I went, well, break it down to her 5K time. He said, but you can't do that. And I said, that's how it works. Sorry, you can. And of course, you know, now Asafa in Berlin runs a 2:11 marathon. And I remember when that was the men's world record.
Yeah.
In my lifetime, that was the men's world record. So, you know, we're suddenly limited only by maybe the opportunity. It's always the case, but the experience of seeing it go off the charts. You know, we're talking about men running under 2 hours in the marathon, and Eliud Kipchoge, of course, has done it, not in a competitive marathon per se, he's done it.
He's done it, yeah.
He's done it. So mentally, we know that this body is capable of doing it. I don't think it's going to become routine for a while, but, you know, impossible is nothing. So I just think it's a very exciting time. And when you say, still as an individual, what is my thinking? I often think, oh, man, I wish I were the CEO of a Fortune 500 company right now. I would be all over the sponsorship of women's soccer or the women's Tour de France or something that to me is such a no-brainer in terms of economic impact, but it'll come. And who's in there first? Maybe grabbing the lion's share, you know?
It'll come. And I think we're already seeing some changes, especially now with globalization, social media. I think, the fight for women in sports is moving quite powerfully still. And you know, I'd like to say that you are and were a trailblazer in that movement, certainly. And I hope that this interview has kind of shown our viewers, our listeners, a little bit of that trailblazing kind of attitude. And I was I wanted to ask you if you had any concluding thoughts. For those listeners.
Yes, Yes, I don't want this to be in any way a negative. I just want it to be an alarm call, okay? Which is okay. That, Lucas, we have so far to go. We really do. I mean, we're talking about something that's in the stratosphere to women who are in some countries who are not allowed to go outside alone, not allowed to choose their partners, not allowed to drive a car, not allowed to get an education. This still exists. And the myths of your uterus falling out and sports being dangerous for women, these things prevail in many, many countries right now. It is unthinkable that we can't. We're trying very hard to reach those women, to give them an opportunity to open their eyes and to have their communities do that. But, you know, many people perceive power as suppression. We see it all the time. I'm sorry it exists. So we all need to contribute to that and make those things change. And we can start with our own families, our own wives, our own girlfriends, our own daughters, and sons. And let's create the opportunities for equality.
Well, thank you, Catherine. It's been really an honor and a pleasure chatting to you. And if you're in the UK, you know, in the coming months, we'd be happy to do a round two. And for those listening who've kind of listened to more of our episodes and have noticed that Ollie's not here, he has had some issues with his internet. So I apologize, Catherine, that you didn't get to hear his soothing voice.
Well, we'll get together another time, Lucas, and all my best to you and Ollie and what you're doing with this project. It's fantastic. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you, Catherine Switzer. This has been the Loaf Podcast. Out.